What's going on? Where is Alex? The question was now heavy on a lot of people's minds. Friends of his, family. If you'd watched any news in Central Kentucky, you knew Alex Johnson's name. And what did Mark Taylor know about his friend's disappearance? Much more than he was willing to tell. I'm Kristen Flum, and this is Taking Alex. In the last episode, Casey explained how she exhausted all of the theories she had about Alex's absence. It's likely he'd gone camping and didn't have service. Had he been in an accident and needed help? Or maybe he just wanted some time away. But as the days crept closer to Christmas, those theories just didn't make sense. She couldn't shake what Lisa had told her.
You know, Friday night when we were on the phone, he said, "Mark is here. He has a surprise for me downstairs. I'll call you later tonight."
By Casey's calculations, based on all the phone calls she'd made, no one could say for sure they'd talked to Alex since Friday evening. Casey decided to make one more phone call, this time to Mark Taylor.
I said, "This is Alex's sister. Have you talked to Alex?" And he said, "Let me call you right back." Now, by that time, he was probably at least the fifth or sixth person that I called, and everyone else made time for me. He was the only one that said, "Let me call you right back." And 45 minutes elapsed until he called me back. And he sounded suspicious. I said, "When's the last time you saw Alex?" Knowing about Friday night, knowing about the phone call, I didn't show my hand. So I said, "When's the last time you saw Alex?" "Oh, it was Wednesday or Thursday of last week." "Okay, Wednesday or Thursday. Which day was it?" You know, I said, "I'm taking notes. You know, which day is it?" "Okay, it was Wednesday. I saw him Wednesday. I took some leather goods over to him. It's my new business. I just, you know, I was giving him an early Christmas present." It's like, "Okay. You didn't see him Friday night?" No, I didn't see him Friday night. No, we were supposed to hang out at Trust, but no, he never showed up." And then he went into his alibi. "You can ask this person. You can ask the DJ. You can ask my friends. I was there. I didn't see Alex that night."
And to be clear, no one else you talked to in those other five or six phone calls went into an alibi?
Absolutely not. They were concerned about Alex. He didn't show any concern. His concern was about, "I can prove that I was here." And so I said, "Well, I know that you showed up at his apartment on Friday night. You said you had a surprise for him and to come downstairs. So you're telling me you didn't show up at his apartment Friday night?" "No, I didn't, no." I'm like, "Okay, Mark, well, just so you know, when I come to Lexington, when I get off work, I'm calling the police. And I'm going to tell them that you came to his house on Friday."
Casey couldn't sit still any longer.
It made me sick. Something was wrong.
She grabbed a gun, just in case, and had a friend drive her to Lexington. It was December 23rd, day three of no contact with Alex, and by now he was supposed to be back home in Bowling Green.
We see Alex's truck outside. You know, one of the neighbors had already told me his truck's still here, so I knew, okay, he hasn't tried to come to Bowling Green. Got in his apartment. All three of his bicycles were still there. All the lights were still on. It looks like he got off work, kicked off his shoes, took off his riding gloves, took off his balaclava. And he had his laptop on the table and his iPod on the couch. It looked like he had been sitting down on the couch talking on the phone and then abruptly left. I kind of thought that he would be unresponsive in the floor. I didn't know. You know, I was scared to death, and I was still hoping that he would just pop up. You know, I was still listening to footsteps, you know, out in the hall, like, "Oh, is that him? Oh, okay." See, I really didn't want to call the police. I didn't want to believe that something had happened to my brother. But it became pretty clear that something had happened, and I called the police, and they sent an officer out. We filed a missing persons report, and he said that, the next day, that they would be contacting me for more information.
Alex is a grown man, police told Casey. Maybe he's laid up with a girl somewhere. He's over 18. He's free to do what he wants. Casey was frustrated by the officer's lack of concern. She'd shared everything she'd learned from his friends with investigators. Police, she says, kept reassuring her he'd show up.
We found his cat outside. It was freezing outside. And she was hungry. I mean, she ate an entire bowl of food. She was upset. She was cold. And I mean, he would never leave his cat like that. You know, she was in and out as she pleased, but she was starving. So that's Monday. She probably hadn't been fed since Friday. So I knew something was wrong.
With no more information than she came with, Casey and her friend took off with Alex's cat back to Bowling Green, where she spent an agonizing, sleepless night at her parents' house. They still had no idea.
I waited to tell my parents until the next morning because there was literally nothing they could do. Number one, I had done everything that could have been done. And number two, they wouldn't have gotten any sleep. My dad's alarm goes off at 5 o'clock in the morning, Tuesday, Christmas Eve. I'm laying in my bed, and I know that I have to go and tell him right now that Alex is missing.
This next part is Casey reading from a victim impact statement they turned over to the court.
I finally mustered the courage to sit my father down at the kitchen table. I sat weeping with my head buried in my hands as I told him his only son was missing. He panicked and started to sob, repeating, "No, no, no." About that time, Moggy came to see the commotion. That's Alex's cat. For a split second, my father stopped crying and pointed to the cat. "Look, he's home. Moggy's here." "No," I said. "I brought her down last night. He's really missing, Dad." The sobbing started again, and it hasn't stopped until this day. That's something that haunts me, is that I had to tell my parents that their son was missing. It was Christmas Eve, and I mean, I'll never forget that.
The hours that passed after that were a blur. As a family this time, Lee and Casey Johnson, along with their uncle, who's a preacher, made the long, quiet trip to Lexington. They went straight to Alex's apartment and called Lexington police again.
And so they sent Officer Conway. He was the game changer. He listened to us and he told us, you know, he was very sensitive to us, and he told us, you know, any missing person, they've always come back. Everything will be fine. I'm sure he's okay. But I told them more about Mark, about my interactions with Mark.
Casey shared everything. And when she drained her mind of any and all leads she could think of, they got back in the car and made the 2.5-hour trip back to Bowling Green. Their family was supposed to be celebrating the holiday together, Alex included. Here's Judy Johnson.
I knew instantly if he was missing and we hadn't heard from him by Christmas Day, I knew that he was gone. But I just tried to keep hope alive, you know, just so we could keep going. No, I knew it wasn't like him not to come home for Christmas. So.
While at that family get-together, the Johnsons got a call from the Lexington Police Department. It was Detective Chris Schoonover, who was assigned to robbery-homicide. He invited Alex's family to sit down with him at the police department the day after Christmas. This time, they all made the trip.
So, of course, as soon as we talked to Schoonover and he said, "This is my, you know, counterpart in the homicide, you know, department," our hearts sank. "You think it's a homicide? You know, you think he's dead?" And they assured us, no, it's a precaution, you know. But they were right. I mean, they knew. I never dreamed that Alex was dead. I never dreamed that Alex was dead. But after all that transpired and the more the investigation went on, I have no doubt in my mind.
One of the hardest things the Johnsons had to learn early on is there's no playbook for how to navigate your loved one's disappearance. How long do you wait to call police? When do you worry? What to expect from detectives once a report is made? Why haven't we heard anything? All thoughts that the Johnson family couldn't silence, no matter how hard they tried.
But we were just dying. And you know, we felt like they were just waiting for the phone records. And we just, you know, things weren't happening fast enough for us. So that was very difficult. And so that's why we hired a private detective to see, you know, what else we could bring to light.
Casey went back and forth several times while Alex was missing, knocked on doors, called hospitals, called jails, even took a trip to the place AT&T representatives told her Alex's phone last pinged. It was a popular, off-the-beaten-path restaurant and music joint called Riptides on the River. It sat feet from the banks of the Kentucky River.
But I didn't know about this restaurant, and I didn't know that Mark had worked there. And so when I learned that, I called Rob. As soon as Rob was put on the case, I called Rob. Hey, Mark used to work there. This is where Alex's phone pinged. Something, you know, that's not a coincidence.
Rob Wilson, I'm a detective with the Lexington Police Department. Been on the department 22 years, been in homicide 19.
Homicide detectives within the Lexington Police Department rotate or take turns working cases. In late December of 2013, Detective Wilson was next up. He'd soon learn he was taking Alex's. It began with a call from Detective Schoonover, who happened to be in the office when the Johnson family filed the missing persons report.
And he called me and he's like, hey, we don't need to do anything tonight, but I got a bad feeling about this one. You're next up. We might want to meet up tomorrow morning. So again, we both had little kids, let them open presents, and I was probably out the door at 10:30.
It was Christmas morning, and it was about to get interesting. Detective Wilson has worked countless homicide investigations, and I asked him how this one stacked up.
Right up there. For lots of reasons. Lexington's a really, really safe city. We do have some shootings and some murders, but most of the time our victims are people that have voluntarily entered into a crime which can lead to violence and shooting and death. It's very rare that Lexington has an innocent victim or a whodunit type murder. This is certainly one of those that was a really challenging investigation right from the get-go.
He started running with what he did have, everything Casey was able to dig up, and he wanted to know more about that phone call with Lisa.
How instrumental was Lisa Horobin in the initial phases of your investigation?
Everything. It was Mr. Taylor's bad fortune to go knock on Alex's door on the 20th. While he was still on the phone with Lisa, Lisa knew Mark's voice. She heard the knock on the door, opened it up. She heard Mark say, hey, come on downstairs. I've got a surprise for you, which later turned out to be quite ominous.
Detective Wilson spent all of Christmas Day making phone calls to Alex's friends. Every one of them jumped at the request to come down and talk to police, anything to help find Alex. At some point, the phone rang at the police department. It was an attorney for Mark Taylor, who assured them Mark would be down later to offer what he could.
And then Paul calls back and says, hey, hate to tell you this, but Mark will not be making a statement. We're like, a statement? We're just wanting to know where he and Alex went. And it's like, because I understand, guys, but he's not going to be making statements. Like, you mean he's not going to assist us in helping us find Alex? He's like, I'm afraid so. And I was like, well, he's told us a lot then.
Mark's refusal to sit down with police was a roadblock, but certainly not enough to deter this detective. In fact, it put him hot on Mark Taylor's trail. Detective Wilson started tracking where else Mark might have been that night.
We found out he went to Trust Bar that evening, and so we went and tried to get video footage. Which we did, hoping to see Alex so we'd have another lead to go on. Believe around 11:45 that evening on the 20th, we see Mark Taylor and Timothy Ballard, who we call Tiny, walk into Trust Bar. They stay till roughly closing. So we don't have any further news of Alex other than Mark Taylor had contact with him around 8:45 on the 20th, and he shows up at, you know, a bar a couple of hours later without Alex.
So surveillance video puts Mark Taylor in downtown Lexington the night of December 20th with a man named Timothy Ballard, or Tiny. He's affectionately called that because of his 6'8", 425-pound frame. The Alabama native is also a felon, previously convicted of armed robbery in his home state. And in 1993, while serving time in jail on the state charges, court documents show that Ballard wrote and mailed a letter to then-President George Bush that read, quote, "Dear Mr. President, I am going to kill you. I'm going to send you a pipe bomb. Love, Timothy Ballard." Later, Ballard admitted to Secret Service agents he did it because he wanted to be incarcerated at a federal institution. He said he'd been threatened while inside the Mobile County Metro Jail and was told that he would be killed if he was moved to an Alabama prison with those men. Tiny fessed up to the plot, entered a guilty plea, and was sentenced to 21 months. And with a record like that, obviously employment after all of his jail time was served was tough, almost impossible. That's where Mark Taylor came in.
Do you know Mark Taylor?
Yes, I do.
And how did you meet him?
I was working at a bar, and he was a bartender.
What bar was that, Mr. Ballard?
Riptides.
And where is Riptides located?
I don't know the exact address, but, you know, it's down on the river.
On the Kentucky River?
Yes.
What did you do at Riptides?
I was working security there.
All right. I've heard the term bouncer.
Yeah.
Now, did you do anything else to make money besides working at Riptides?
I was his personal driver.
When did that start? When did you become his personal driver?
About the middle of October when they shut Riptides down.
Okay. So how long did you know Mark Taylor before this thing happened in December?
6 months.
Okay. Do you know what else Mark Taylor did for a living besides work at Riptides?
He had a glass business and a leather business.
Glass and leather?
Mm-hmm.
Did he ever talk to you about where he got other places that he got his money?
I seen where it was.
I'm sorry, what?
I seen where it was.
What does that mean?
It means he didn't have to tell me. I seen.
And what did you see?
He was a marijuana seller.
All right, so he hired you to be a driver in the middle of October.
Yes, ma'am.
What were you to do?
He had a million phones, so he couldn't drive, you know.
He had a what?
A million different phones.
A million different phones?
I mean, he had 3-4 different phones. So, okay. I mean.
Well, how does that tie into not being able to drive?
You can't drive and play with 3 phones at the same time.
Okay.
You know? I know he had his license. From what he told me, his license were messed up for a small period of time, but
okay.
I was a driver for that period of time.
Okay. And how long did that period of time last? You said it started in mid-October?
It started in October. It ended the first year.
Was it only on the weekends?
It started only on weekends, yes.
And tell me how it started on the weekends. What would you do?
My job wasn't really that difficult. I'd open the door for the man, I'd let him in the car, I'd drive him to different spots he needed to go to, he'd do business with different people, I drove him to the bar, and then I drove him and some of his intoxicated friends home.
Okay. Now, when you all were at a bar, mm-hmm. were you drinking?
No, ma'am.
You said it started just being on the weekends. Did it become more?
It became more just about 7 days a week.
That's Tiny's take on the job he was given. Here it is in Mark's words.
And did you at some point meet Mr. Ballard?
Yes.
Do you remember when that was?
It wasn't until about a year and a half later. I had been working at Riptides. I was the bartender at Riptides. We were a really good group that worked there. And Tim was one of the... And I'm going to say random because there were a lot of different bouncers that came through. It was more just a hired hand. It was people that that were big and strong and could tend the gates and throw people out, because Riptides in itself is kind of the Wild West. It's the furthest establishment from Lexington that is covered by Lexington PD. So any call that would go out from Riptide would take 30 minutes to respond in general. So you needed the biggest, baddest people in the area to help manage those situations.
Did you develop a friendship with Mr. Ballard?
No.
Did you develop a working relationship with Mr. Ballard?
Yes.
Okay. Explain that to the jury.
It was common practice to go out and enjoy an evening, you know, when you were off. As bartenders, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, you were essentially relegated to your bar, wherever it was. Those were the nights that you went out. If you're in the industry, then you would usually go out on a Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. That was kind of your weekend to release or to let go. It was kind of a joke among people because of his size and stature that wouldn't it be kind of funny to have him around at the bar, you know, drive us around or do whatever. I knew that he, when the Riptides closed down, he didn't have a job. He needed a job. He pleaded with me multiple times to find him a job because I knew the industry here in town. I couldn't get him one as much as possible. I tried. I couldn't get him one. I would go to a local bar and request that he come with me so that we could speak to the head of the security there, and nobody would hire him on. And finally, I said, hell with it. We'll just, you want $75? I'll give you $75 to drive around all my friends and be essentially a taxi driver. I'm a huge proponent for partying responsibly. If you're going to be irresponsible, plan for it. Have a taxi driver so you don't drive drunk. Be responsible with it if you're going to be it. I'm 31 years old and I've never had a DUI for a good reason. It seemed like the taxi driver that was my good friend that always used to service me and my friends was, I would run into issues late at night when we needed a ride.
Service me? The way Mark Taylor talked about his hired help has been questioned at length by investigators, whether it was the taxi driver or Tiny or other people Mark Taylor had business relationships with. They noted that he seemed to talk down to them.
He's not worthy of the title, Mr. Ballard, is he? To you?
He was called Tim a lot of times.
I get the impression, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that you think Mr. Ballard's beneath you.
No.
You don't think he's of your station in life, do you?
No, he just needed help at that time.
And when asked if he was a social friend of yours, do you remember what your response was?
No.
No, just like that. No. Not good enough for you, was he?
He was just socially awkward, his size, things like that. He wasn't really conversational. He wasn't a people person. Right. And in a social scene, he would stick out like a sore thumb.
Still, Mark Taylor kept him close. Whatever Mark needed, Tiny was tasked with doing it. And police argued that was never more evident than the 48 hours leading up to the night Alex disappeared. Timothy Ballard did everything he was instructed to do, including driving Mark to Alex's North Hanover apartment to see his friend one last time. Next time on Taking Alex.
Oh my gosh, Kramer. I don't know where they went, but I hope they found them. But he'll be back here today.
We were just completely powerless, at the mercy of getting a phone call. And we did, I think, the 25th of January. And they said, Alex isn't with us anymore. I cried so hard, I puked.